It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Yesterday, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that a state college grant program for minority students is unconstitutional.
Created in 1985 by the state legislature, the Minority Undergraduate Retention Grant Program offers up to $2,500 in financial assistance to students who are Black, American Indian, Hispanic, or from some parts of Southeast Asia. In the 2023-24 school year, that program provided $440,000 for 770 students awarded based on financial need.
But in a unanimous ruling, the court found the program violates the 14th Amendment, which guarantees equal protection under the law regardless of race or ethnicity. The decision aligns with a 2023 ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court that limited race-based college admissions.
For a look at the legal and constitutional side of that ruling, we're joined now by Howard Schwaber, Emeritus Professor of Political Science and affiliate faculty member at the University of Wisconsin Law School. Howard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
We see a big split sometimes in our state Supreme Court. Not this time, a unanimous decision here. Why didn't we see any dissent? Why did all the justices line up and agree with the initial plaintiffs?
Well, the agreement is a little bit more surface than it appears. The short answer is that the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in SFFA, the Harvard and University of North Carolina affirmative action case, really left them no room for maneuver. Under the logic of that case, there was a 100% chance that this challenge was going to succeed. But it is worth noting that Jill Karofsky wrote a lengthy and impassioned concurring opinion in which she expressed her deep, I can't state this strongly enough, her angry disagreement with what the U.S. Supreme Court did in that case, her embrace of the dissents by Sotomayor and Jackson at the U.S. Supreme Court, and her clear statement that she wishes it would be possible to rule otherwise. Given, however, what the state of the Supreme Court precedent is, the state court had no choice. And of course, Annette Ziegler, who wrote the opinion on behalf of the court, is an enthusiastic supporter of the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling.
What was that U.S. Supreme Court ruling? What was in there that so severely limited the state Supreme Court's ability to act, even though parts of the court, as you say, did not like that ruling?
So we have to back up a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's a gigantic historical shift that takes place roughly around 2000. Historically, before that, the Equal Protection Clause was understood to protect minorities against actions by the majority. The phrase was discrete and insular minority, and it went back to James Madison's fear of majoritarian tyranny. Starting in the 1990s or around 2000, there was kind of a conservative constitutional revolution, a pushback in that area that said, no, the question is not whether the group being affected is a minority or the majority. The point is that certain kinds of classifications are unacceptable and the Constitution should be colorblind. Now, what that means in practice is that anytime there was a racial classification, strict scrutiny would be triggered. That is, the law would be struck down unless the government could meet a very high standard of showing a compelling interest and that there was no other way to achieve their goals. In SFFA, the U.S. Supreme Court for the first time said that affirmative action programs in college admissions could not meet that standard pretty much ever. And so in this case, the funding program had to be evaluated, under that same strict scrutiny standard, and that's what happened. And Ziegler found that Wisconsin could not show a sufficiently compelling interest, given the ruling of SFFA, and that the means it had chosen were too racially discriminatory. All of that is just the application of this technical legal standard that applies in what you might think of as the most disfavored possible category of government actions. And there's a reason that there's a saying that strict scrutiny is strict in theory and fatal in fact.
And one argument from universities in the past has been, hey, as a university, part of our mission is bringing a diverse group of people. That is our compelling reason to, say, do admissions with some kind of racial preference or scoring, or these retention grants. That idea that this is a compelling interest seems to be rejected under that U.S. Supreme Court ruling.
That's exactly right. And to be slightly more precise, what the Supreme Court said is this might be a compelling interest, but it's too amorphous, too hard to define, and above all, too difficult for judges to measure for us to allow it to be used as a standard. And so Justice Ziegler just quoted that language about amorphousness, that the idea of diversity is too amorphous to be measurable by courts, and said that cannot qualify as a compelling state interest. The most interesting part of the oral argument was when the state of Wisconsin tried to argue that there's a different compelling interest, which is retention. Mm-hmm. That is, they argued that there's a crisis of retention among these minority students, partly due to financial concerns, that these grants would help solve that problem. The lawyer for Wisconsin conceded that no court had ever accepted that theory before. And rather unsurprisingly, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in Justice Ziegler's words, declined to be the first.
And in one of the concurrences here, somebody went into that argument a little bit, and I got the impression they were saying that might be a compelling interest, but you haven't given us the data. You haven't given us the statistics that say these groups, these minority groups, are not being retained at an appropriate rate.
Well, that was the other problem, the other big problem with Wisconsin's case. So the law was passed, as you noted in the introduction, in 1985. And the particular grant program we're talking about is one that provides money to attend private colleges, technical colleges, and others. The problem, according to the court, was that when the law was adopted in 1985, the data the legislature relied upon to justify the grant program was data from the Wisconsin public universities. That is, there was data showing problems of retention among minority students in public universities, and this was taken to be an indication of discrimination and a problem that needed solving. But as Ziegler pointed out, that data told the legislature nothing about the schools that were actually going to be benefiting from this grant program. Ziegler also ruled that you had to judge the adequacy of the policy justification for a law at the time it was adopted. So the mismatch in the data, the fact that the legislature has never produced specific data about this particular grant program, was another fatal flaw. That actually pointed to an interesting part of the outcome. The Court of Appeals had taken a very broad view and adopted the U.S. Supreme Court's general stance and declared all race-based educational programs in Wisconsin unconstitutional. The Supreme Court did not. Ziegler's opinion carefully focused only on this program, and that emphasis on the inadequacy of the data involved sort of points to why. It does leave open the possibility that some other program might survive the application of this strict scrutiny if the justifying data is better.
Howard, thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Howard Schwaber with the UW Law School and Emeritus Professor of Political Science. Now we're joined by an education policy expert. Taylor Odle is Assistant Professor of Educational Policy Studies at UW-Madison. Taylor, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What do you see as the impact of yesterday's ruling?
So I think as someone who studies the economics of education, two questions come to mind for me. Who was this program serving and what was the program meant to do? Right. At its core, this is a scholarship program meant to help increase affordability for students and families to access college in the state. So I kind of see this as the elimination of a scholarship program helping people do things. As Howard also said, this is a retention grant program. So serving students who are already in college to help get them across the finish line, where we know the data show that there are already these widespread disparities in retention rates across many dimensions, not just across race. And so as someone who cares about increasing opportunity to higher education, to career and technical training, I kind of see this as a double blow to Wisconsin. First, as a scholarship program, and second, as one focused on supporting students who face particularly high barriers already in college.
And the argument that students from these minority groups face higher barriers, that's something that doesn't seem to please the courts at this point. Is there a case for that, though, do you think?
I mean, the data are very clear that opportunity and success are not evenly distributed across groups, right? This applies to racially and ethnic and minoritized groups, but it also applies to other important populations. Veteran students and non-veterans don't persist and attain it the same way. Students who are from low-income backgrounds and high-income families don't do that. Students from rural areas and urban areas don't do it either. And so this program in 1985 was likely the state saying, hey, we see some differences in success rates across students in across the state. What can we do to invest to help equalize those things, right? And that could be for a variety of arguments. It could be for an efficiency argument of, if we already have people in college, if we put in some extra money to help them finish, as a taxpayer and a return on taxpayer dollars, that's going to be a huge ROI, right? So I think of it in that way. But again, going back, at the end of the day, this is a scholarship program. And Wisconsin remains one of the most unaffordable states in the country for students. And that's where I think we should put most of our attention here. This was certainly an important program. As you noted, it served about 770 students. We have over 200,000, enrolled across the state. And so a concern I have is that the average student or family family might see this as a redirection of financial aid dollars from one group toward another, or that their aid is going to change. But that's really not going to happen at the end of the day. We have a bigger problem to deal with.
It is a big and complicated problem to deal with. Do you see a possibility of this kind of drop in the bucket in some ways at the state level, this grant program ending? Could it be redirected in a way that serves students at risk of not being retained, of leaving school because of financial difficulties, if it's not based on race?
Yeah, I hope that and much more, right? So to be perfectly clear, retention grants work, and financial aid is the most sure-fired way of increasing access and completion. The research is crystal clear on that point. I hope that this propels two things. One, I hope that grant program is certainly repurposed to support other students who are seeking to be retained and complete college. But more importantly, I hope that this kind of fringe case, if you will, shines a light and kind of reinvigorates our conversation around affordability in Wisconsin, right? I think we should be saying, okay, great, now folks are satisfied maybe that these dollars are being redirected. At the end of the day, it still doesn't solve the case that our state spends less than half what our peer states spend on financial aid per student.
And briefly, as we wrap up, this is one grant. Do you see universities, if they have a goal of a diverse student body, are there other tools in the toolkit now that admissions policy and now retention funds are set? They've said that's a no-go if it's based on race or minority status.
Yeah, so I mean, universities have a variety of priorities. One is increasing the racial diversity of their student body, but also socioeconomic and geographic, et cetera, et cetera. And so universities have always had a variety of tools at their disposal to increase those levels. As we now get further down this kind of litigation, some of those levers start disappearing, where we can perfectly target at a specific group based on an identity or something like that. But I will see universities as now taking this back as one additional limit or guardrail to keep in mind as they extend those efforts, whether it's targeted recruitment at some high schools, things like that.
Taylor, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
That's Taylor Odle, Assistant Professor of Educational Policy Studies at UW-Madison. We also heard from Howard Schwaber, Emeritus Professor of Political Science and Affiliate Faculty Member at the UW Law School, looking at a state Supreme Court ruling against a state college grant program for retention of certain minority students.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, it's this week's edition of Inside Wisconsin Politics. Find out how Democrats running for governor are trying to stand out in a crowded field during and after their state party convention. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Barrett. The Democratic candidates running for Wisconsin governor are trying to separate themselves from the pack with the August primary around the corner.
Coming out of the state party convention last weekend, our team of political reporters at Inside Wisconsin Politics break down who is standing out among the seven candidates on the ballot as they begin ramping up campaign ad spending.
The reporters also check in on the latest developments in some big election law cases in Wisconsin that are progressing through the courts.
Joining the discussion are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson and political reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
So, Anya, I think it's fair to say that this primary campaign is not going to be won or lost based on what happened in the room at the state party convention over the weekend. But you did have all seven candidates there. They were under the same set of rules, speaking to the same group of Democratic activists. What was it like?
Yeah, you know, I say this with all due respect. Normal people do not attend state party conventions, right? These are like the most diehard Democrats, the most diehard Republicans who go to that convention. And so these are the people who are like the most energized about their party and are going to be the ones to hopefully, bring in their fellow but like less excited Democrats. And so I think that was kind of the vibe of the speeches that you were getting from the gubernatorial candidates, which is that they were trying to appeal to this base, right, the most kind of committed Democrats possible, and also make the case not only that they should stand out in the 7-person primary going into August, but that they are also most sort of best positioned to beat Tom Tiffany in November. And so those are kind of two different arguments that you need to be making, the one that makes you most appealing to Democrats and then the one that makes you most appealing to kind of your average Wisconsinite. And there was a lot of kind of threading of that needle while also trying to get excitement. So it was definitely a little bit of a dance going on, but that, I think, was kind of the overarching theme.
What common thread stood out to you? I mean, like, what was a theme that stood out in all the speeches, or at least most of them?
Yeah, so kind of two. So the Tom Tiffany mm-hmm. theme, and also, by extension, Donald Trump, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of trying to tie the two of those together. But then affordability was kind of the word of the day. The theme of the convention was reclaiming the American dream. And each of the candidates talked in either broader or more specific terms, sort of depending on the candidate, about what they would do to basically put more money in people's pockets, lower prices, make things more affordable in Wisconsin.
All right. So, Rich, you and I were not at this convention, although we had a chance to listen to these speeches later. What stood out to you?
Well, Anya already mentioned it. There was a lot of talk about Donald Trump and the chaos in Washington from his administration. That's according to these Democratic candidates. And it's pretty obvious why they would focus on the president, and his, you know, popularity rating is pretty low in polling. So it seems like they're hoping that Trump will be a liability for Tom Tiffany as they move forward in this campaign. And also there's only one Republican in the race, so they're able to focus their attacks on one person. Meanwhile, you know, Tom Tiffany doesn't have to worry about trying to stand out among Republican competitors in his primary, or in a primary. So that's what stuck out. But there was some other things that stood out. In terms of, like, the closest thing to criticizing other Democrats seemed to come from State Senator Kelda Royce. And she just basically said the party cannot afford to pick a nominee that would put a Democratic trifecta, that is the state Senate, state assembly, and the governor's office, in jeopardy. So no names were named, but people might be able to infer who or how many, you know, people she might have been talking about. And of course, there was a number of, like, pretty bold promises from some of these candidates as well.
Yeah, criticism did jump out to me. There was another one, I think you could argue, from Francesca Hong, saying that yes, when you go out on the campaign trail, people can detect BS. We're not going to say the word because it's a family show here, guys. But she was essentially, without naming names, saying the other candidates aren't as authentic as me, is the way that I heard it. I'll tell you one other thing that kind of stood out to me. Upon first review of the speeches, I went away thinking these felt like general election speeches a little bit. I mean, this is a primary where they're almost going to have to, some of them are going to have to get negative if they want to climb the ladder and be the party's candidate. And, you know, even the criticisms we just mentioned, Rich, weren't exactly super negative. And the messages, I could absolutely imagine them in a general election campaign against Tom Tiffany. But they are, Anya, they're trying to win this Democratic primary among a smaller group of voters right now.
Right, but it is this balancing act where, as Rich said, right, they are going for a trifecta. And that was another big theme of the weekend, is this idea that Democrats really think that they could take over all three chambers of government. And so they need to try to distinguish themselves. And most of them don't have that kind of, you know, statewide visibility. So they are still trying to get just, like, baseline name recognition, which is important for a primary, but then also not do anything to harm other Democrats. Because, you know, if you have sort of a 1 in 7 chance, and I know that's not exactly how statistics work, but something like that, and so you don't move forward, you don't want to have weakened your party, you don't want to be giving Tom Tiffany sort of free fodder for your opponents. And so I think that we will see a little bit more maybe of those veiled attacks, but in a way that's more aimed at sort of holding themselves up rather than necessarily going negative at this point. Because Tom Tiffany, as Rich mentioned, is sort of in a field by himself. He technically has an opponent, but more or less he's the presumptive nominee. And so he's not going to get weakened in a primary. So they need to be very careful themselves.
It can work against you in a primary, particularly a Democratic primary, to go negative, where you have voters who have kind of that same idea that, like, look, the goal is November. Stop fighting and show us how you're different. Rich, anything that jump out at you there and what Ani was just mentioning?
Well, I wanted to kind of go back to when she mentioned, you know, the slights and the electability and all that stuff. One of the candidates, you know, early on, even before he announced, Mandela Barnes, former lieutenant governor, former state representative, before he got in the race, some Democrats were publicly saying, well, he lost in 2022. We don't need that again. But during his speech, he brought that up and he said, well, that's why I'm more experienced. I've been through this, came within one percentage point of Ron Johnson in 2022. That's why I have the experience, that and the other resume stuff that he's got. So I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, there was a lot of conversation about electability, which again, I think speaks to trying to signal that they could beat Tom Tiffany in the fall. And so you had, for example, Fran Hong pointed to the fact that she's, if not the most far left candidate, certainly among them. And the fact that some people have brought that up as a liability against her, as passionate as her supporters are, her opponents are sort of equally passionate. And she talked about, well, actually, I am part of a legacy of Wisconsin progressives who were elected. So rather than that being a liability for me, that actually makes me more electable because people are excited about someone who doesn't bring BS. And David Crowley as well. He pointed to the fact that there has never been a black candidate who has won statewide office. And he says that everywhere he goes, people ask him, can a black man become governor in Wisconsin? And he said, well, I can, for the following reasons. And so he named that sort of elephant in the room as a way of also drawing attention to his record. And so, again, just kind of the way that the candidates are trying to distinguish themselves, not just on their own terms, but also for what they can deliver in November.
And there was a straw poll at this convention, Anya, and I feel like, you know, it's kind of fun to talk about, but we should say 1,000 grains of salt here for this poll, because this is not a scientific poll. The margin of error would be, look, I'm not qualified to calculate it, very high.
Charles Franklin would have a lot to say about this one.
He would say, don't pay attention to straw polls would be my guess. But you had all these Democrats in a room, and if they wanted to, they could go to the booth run by WISP Politics, which does these at all the conventions, and you could vote for your candidate of choice among the primary field. And how did that resolve?
Yeah, really interesting. Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez came out first. And again, if Fran Hong is sort of further to the left, she's a little bit further to the center. But then Fran Hong was number two. And so you kind of have a little bit of the polls of what the party is presenting right now, one who might be doing better in a primary race, again, given just sort of the excitement that's around her, that's Fran Hong, and then one who perhaps could appeal to a broader audience, that is Sarah Rodriguez, who comes from a more of a business background. She was a healthcare executive and a nurse. She flipped a Republican seat when she ran for the assembly in the Waukesha suburbs. And so you have these two different models, and it kind of looked like Democrats a little bit split among them.
So I want to throw some caution at the poll here, the straw poll. I was just looking back at the 2018 straw poll when you had even more candidates running for governor, kind of depending on when you mentioned them. You probably are aware of this by now, or have heard it or seen it recently, but that year, Kelda Royce won the straw poll. She went on to finish third in the primary, a distant third, but she won it overwhelmingly at convention. Do you happen to know where Tony Evers placed in that straw poll? This is the beginning of our quiz section here, guys. So Tony Evers placed third. Okay. He had 91 votes compared to Kelda Royce's 184 that year. Right behind him were Andy Gronick and Dana Walks. They have something in common. They both dropped out of the race by the end of June that year. So the convention was in June 2nd, I think, and they were dropped out by the 21st and 22nd. So
right. So again, appealing to quote unquote normal people versus appealing to the most kind of revved up Democrats who follow every kind of twist and turn about that. So it doesn't necessarily translate to what a general voter or general audience is interested in.
Sure. And there's also a certain amount of campaigning you can do in the room at these things. You can say, hey, get over to that desk that's run by WISP Politics, and I think you should really vote for us.
Bring your people.
Bring
along.
Your people, absolutely. And I'm sure some of that went on at this convention. So, I did want to play a little game with you two, since we have you here. Would that be okay?
All right.
Sure.
I'm ready.
You have no choice, right? We're recording a live show here, so I was just looking back through these speeches and through the benefit of being able to look at the transcript, the number of times that certain words were mentioned in these things, you can see kind of who hit themes really hard. So the first one I looked for was Trump. Who said Trump the most? Anybody want to hazard a guess? Rich, you go first.
I'm going to say Rodriguez.
I think it might have been Joel Brennan.
All right. All right. Rich, you win, buddy. You got Sarah Rodriguez and Mandela Barnes were right up at the top there, mentioned him six times. Joel Brennan after them. And then everybody mentioned Trump at least once. But Rodriguez and Barnes kind of hitting, to my ear, similar themes in those messages, too. Like, they sounded like maybe they were running a little bit of a November campaign or a safer message in their speeches. Okay, how about Tiffany? And not, to be clear, nobody mentioned the Truman Capote book that was adapted into a movie and later, you know, celebrated in a song. Who mentioned Tiffany, Tom Tiffany, the most?
Gosh, I'm just stuck on that dad joke now.
I'm proud of that one, you know. that song, by the way, in my head all the time. And I hated it when it came out, but the beauty of nostalgia.
I'm going to vote Roy's, well, for this, of
course.
There
you go. There you go.
That is not.
We got you. Kelda Roy's, how about you? Who mentioned Tiffany the most?
Missy Hughes.
All right. Good guesses, everybody. Sarah Rodriguez was tops in Tiffany mentions. Followed by Joel Brennan, Mandel Barnes, and Kelda Roy's mentioned. And once David Crowley, Missy Hughes, and Francesca Hong didn't even mention Tom Tiffany in this thing.
Yeah. Was I there at all?
It was kind of interesting. No, I mean, I think it's the kind of thing you assume that you heard a bunch of people say, and then you go back and look and realize, well, they didn't actually mention that specific guy. I predict whoever wins this primary, though, will mention him a lot in TV ads between now and November. Okay, how about this? We've got a Democratic governor right now. And a lot of these people have worked with or for this Democratic governor. Who do you think might have mentioned Evers a few times? Rich, what do you think?
I would say it'd have to be someone that worked within the administration or alongside him. So that narrows it down to four people. I would say Brennan.
Yeah. Okay. Anya?
I think it was also Brennan. He also made a point of saying, fix the darn roads. And so he seemed to be really tying himself to Evers.
It was Mandela Barnes, Tony Evers' former lieutenant governor, followed by Joel Brennan, his former DOA secretary, followed by Sarah Rodriguez, his current lieutenant governor, and Missy Hughes, his former WEDIC CEO. No mention of Tony Evers by Francesca Hong, Kelda Roy's, or David Crowley. So
no big surprise.
Tony Evers back there taking notes like, I see you. I see you. Okay, one more, I promise. And this is a little different. You got a chance at this convention to differentiate yourself. One way is you can just tell these delegates, I'm different. Who said only candidate, as in I'm the only candidate?
Oh, I know this one.
Okay, let's hear it.
Fran Hong said, I am the only candidate who proposes a moratorium on data centers.
And free child care. Mm-hmm. And you are correct, Anya. She mentioned it four times. This was interesting to me, Rich. Kelda Roy's was there. She mentioned it a couple times. Her message was, I'm the only candidate who's been a legislator. I got bills, was basically what she was saying. And then David Crowley, the only candidate who has executive experience, and nobody else used that turn of phrase. Big grain of salt for that one, too, which is very unscientific, but I find it fun to run through that stuff.
Unscientific, but you probably made a spreadsheet.
I did make a spreadsheet. You're
a word
darn right.
Cloud,
yeah,
somewhere.
It made it a lot easier for me to list those things real quick. So we want to move on real quick to some legal developments this week. A few small legal developments in big cases. Rich, first, let's start with, there was this decision by the state Supreme Court to hear an appeal in a redistricting case, congressional redistricting case. Is this a big deal or an incremental step?
It's pretty incremental. So these are about the congressional maps. There's two of them that have been, two of these appeals of these cases challenging the congressional map as gerrymandered for various reasons, various types of gerrymandering. And it sounds exciting that it's made it to the Supreme Court, but all they're doing in both situations is they will be deciding whether or not these three-judge panels they appointed were correct in how they dismissed these challenges. And those panels essentially said they dismiss them because they don't have the authority to overturn the maps, which were put in place by the Supreme Court, and a lower court cannot overrule a higher court like that. So what I've been told is that that probably means these will go back through the court system, back to the lower courts and work their way up, but the Supreme Court justices will have to decide whether or not these gerrymandering claims can even move forward. So that's a big question, but in short, it likely doesn't mean that there's going to be any new map before the 2026 election. There's just not enough time.
Okay, and lightning round here, you had a case you covered on voter rolls. What happened there?
So the federal government, the Department of Justice, wants to get unredacted voter registration information from Wisconsin, and that includes, you know, driver's license numbers and Social Security numbers, the last four digits. The Elections Commission hasn't provided that. They've given a different list that's publicly available, but essentially the case was dismissed last month in federal court. It's being appealed. The DOJ is appealing it to the Seventh Circuit. But again, it'll take a while, and there's been other examples of this around the nation where the DOJ has been losing these cases.
One of those we'll have to keep an eye on. And then, Anya, the false electors case in Wisconsin, what happened there?
They pleaded not guilty to 11 counts of felony forgery, including Wisconsin's own Jim Troupas. Well, he's also trying to get the case moved out of Dane County Circuit Court, and so that case continues to unfold.
All right. Thank you both for keeping an eye on those. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us. Our colleague Zach Schultz will be back in a few weeks.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson and political reporters Anya Van Wagtendonk and Rich Kramer.
Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org.
If you have a question that you'd like the reporters to talk about, email it to InsideWisconsinPolitics@WPR.org. Please include your first and last name in your message.
Coming up, Milwaukee singer-songwriter Kyle Feerick has a new folk rock album. He talks about his musical journey.
Singing is some of the most fun that I have. I just close my eyes. Any issues or troubles you're having in life kind of melt away.
The album called Shine On, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. With the summer solstice just around the corner, the countdown to shorter days begins.
Writer Chris Hardy reminds us of summer's simple joys and how to make the most of the season before it slips away. This essay is featured in his book, Back Home, Country Tales Through the Seasons.
Spring officially ended with the summer solstice, which is Latin for sun stands still. The sun reached its greatest distance in the northern hemisphere when it rested directly at noon over the Tropic of Cancer, marking the longest day of the year. I've always found it somewhat odd and a tad bit depressing that the moment summer begins, the days begin to shorten. It just seems like we were getting cheated for some reason. The Celts and the Druids celebrated the summer solstice with fun events like dancing, bonfires, mortgage burnings, film festivals, and neighborhood keg parties. The partying didn't stop until the last dram of grog was consumed, and everyone passed out around the stone circles of Stonehenge and Avebury. Mother Nature moves with blissful ignorance, despite disturbing and somewhat frightening news and the constant onslaught of politics and partisan bickering. She's immune to viral videos and ignorant memes and other human fascinations. We can even screw up her dance card with atmospheric interference, and she still moves through the seasonal recital with effortless grace. Farmers are partners in the seasonal dance, but even those hardworking folk should take a break every once in a while to inhale the floral bouquet. We all need to unplug from the machine and take in a few of summer's best performances. Here are some of my recommended highlights. the first tomato from the garden, a tasty delight that makes the weeding and hoeing all worthwhile. Standing barefoot at the edge of a swimming hole with black mud oozing between your toes, nearly giddy as you anticipate the refreshing plunge into the chilly spring-fed water. Sitting on the porch listening to the rumble of distant thunder and marveling at nature's awesome fireworks show as a storm begins to move in, kicking up a welcome cool breeze. Relaxing around a crackling campfire, toasting marshmallows to a caramel brown. Lying on a blanket and counting the brilliant specks of light in the night summer sky until you lose track of your celestial senses gazing into some distant galaxy. Running through the grass until your feet are wet with dew from chasing fireflies with a glass jar capturing nature's living night lights. Topping off a summer picnic with a big piece of juicy watermelon, your face and neck sticky with juice as you see who can spit the farthest seed. Biting into a steaming ear of fresh corn on the cob, dripping in butter and lightly salted. Pulling out of the driveway with a fully laden car and excited kids on the first day of the family vacation. Taking a drive through the country and inhaling the scent of mowed alfalfa, drying in neat rows on ribbon-like fields of green. As my great uncle used to say all summer long, the days are getting shorter, and before you know it, winter will be here. I think that was his no-nonsense Germanic way of making sure that all of the summer work was done so you entered the winter with no regrets. Have no regrets. Summer is here. Catch it while you can.
Chris Hardy is an author who lives in West Salem. This piece was produced by Tyler Ditter. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton.
This is WPR News.
A new album from Milwaukee singer-songwriter Kyle Feerick is bookended with talking snippets like this.
Well, you won't have any trouble mastering this, Chris. It's like a rhythm beat, like this.
Feerick's music is known for experimental elements. Some of these talking clips that Feerick set to music are from a record of 1930s and 1940s radio bloopers.
Feerick is known for his catchy melodies and his folk rock and layering in instruments like piano, saxophone, and violin. His fourth full-length album is called Shine On.
I wrote the songs over probably a 3 or 4 year period. And when I started writing them for this record, I thought, I'm going to try and do something a little different and push myself. So I kind of taught myself piano basically well enough to write some songs using the piano instead of guitar like I typically do. So I think through that, writing the songs on piano, I came up with some songs and music that I wouldn't have otherwise written on guitar.
There is this richness in your music as you layer in so many instruments. I hear violin and piano, saxophone, horns. How do you create the ensemble? You know, how do you create the instrumentation of those parts into your music?
Well, when I am first writing a song, as I'm writing it, I can hear the other instruments that I want to have included in that song. So I'll write a song and I think, boy, this would be great with strings, or this would be great with horns, or, you know, this lead melody should be a Wurlitzer piano. And so I kind of hear all of that when I write the song. And then when we get into the studio, I'm blessed to have around 20 musicians that I play with, record with. And so I will call on them to help write string arrangements or horn arrangements. And so That's how it all comes together.
And when you add those instruments, you have to share the stage and be open to how the other musician is playing and interpreting your song. What is that collaboration like?
Well, when I first started writing songs or really involving many more musicians to participate in the recording, I would write a song and I had a melody in mind for, let's say, the horn part. And so I would tell the musician, okay, here's the horn melody. But I quickly learned that it's best to say, you know, okay, here's where I want the horns. You know, if you could write the horn arrangement. A lot of times the other musician will come up with something that, you know, is very different than what you would have, but superior. And it's like, yeah, that's what it needs, you know? So a lot of times, you know, having a general idea of the song and the melodies, but then sometimes you relinquish the reins and let them write the melody for the horn part. And it all comes together even better than if you had done it all yourself.
In your title track, Shine On, your lyrics seem to reference how your songs have never gone away. Were you writing songs and making music during your nearly decade away from recording albums?
Yeah, I would say, well, the last full-length record was in 2017. It was the album Heart. And then I did put out in 2018 an EP that had four songs on it, and then a single in 2023. But I would say pretty much between 2018 and 2022, I wrote all of these songs. And then in 2023, started tracking them all, and it took quite a while to. It's just there are so many layers that it just takes a while to get all the musicians into the studio and get it all put together.
And we just hear the end result, right? We don't know all of the many steps that go into making an album.
Right. There are a lot of steps, and you want to make sure you do each one right and take the time that you're pleased with, you know, what you're putting out.
You work as a funeral director at your fifth-generation family funeral home in Shorewood. Does being in the funeral industry influence the music you make?
I think not directly, but sometimes when I listen back to my lyrics, I find it interesting that it does have a correlation. So I guess the answer is yes, but it's very subconscious. And when I'm writing lyrics to a song, some of them, I'm like, oh, that kind of, I could see that, how that interplays with the work I do. But it's certainly not a conscious thing when I'm writing music.
Do you think does being a musician help you be a better funeral director?
Yes, certainly. The music and art is such a soul-enriching thing and such a great part of being alive that it makes me a happier person, and the happier I am, the better job I can do serving others.
You bookend this album with these talking snippets, and let's sample a talking clip from the opening track, Protostar. What are these clips, and where did you find them?
Yeah, I enjoy collecting records, and when I'm in record stores, if I see an old record that, you know, just has talking on it, for example, like you mentioned, a bowling instructional record from the 50s or radio bloopers from the 30s and 40s, I'll pick those up, and I have a special turntable that I will listen to it, and I hear a little line that I'm like, oh, that's a really cool little line. And I'll record that. And then I've built up this large library of all these different talking samples, I guess just for fun, but also to someday layer into a song. And these instrumental pieces that bookend the record seem to be the perfect opportunity to layer some of those talking samples in.
That must be fun to figure out what works where, what kind of message it sends, because it's just another aspect of, I suppose, being a singer-songwriter.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun because it's part of the art, but a different part, you know, layering in these samples. And it was like making I can't paint or draw, but it's kind of the equivalent with music and making a collage. And it was a lot of fun to do. And while I was working on it, I had my 10-year-old son, Ollie, who was down in the studio with me. And I was like, what do you think of this, Ollie? Yeah, I like that one. And so in the liner notes on the record, we gave him assistant engineer a credit on there.
Crowdsourcing, right.
Yeah.
You know, Kyle, your music has references that I hear to the passage of time, like in the song Nothing Lasts.
Times pass and things keep rearranging. Well, day by day, the sun keeps on blazing. When nothing lasts, it's truly amazing. And on this path, it's our future we're chasing. When everything is in your way. Everything. When you gotta push to make it sing. When you know the love that you could bring.
How do you think about time showing up in your music?
That's a good question. I think it, again, kind of refers to my subconscious. So it's a little hard for me to answer that question. But I do notice that if I try and write lyrics, they're going to be cheesy. It's going to sound forced. So what I need to do is, you know, I come up with some chords that I really like, and then it just kind of flows out of me. And so I'm, as much as you, kind of looking at these lyrics and deciphering maybe what they mean. But I do notice that that is a theme. Earthly elements and time seem to be in a lot of the lyrics of the songs that I write. The first record full length I put out was The Sky It Moves. And then the EP I put out was Light All Around, and this one is called Shine On. And so it's, yeah, I see these themes, but I don't really have any answers as to why they are the themes. I guess I just kind of, my subconscious just gravitates towards them as interesting or.
You follow the chord as well.
Yes, that's right. I'm trying to just let the words and the music kind of flow out of me.
What does singing and making music mean to your life?
Singing is some of the most fun, true joy that I have. When I'm singing, I just close my eyes and focus on the singing. And so it, kind of any issues or troubles you're having in life when you're singing kind of melt away for that period while you're doing it. And so it really brings true joy. And I would say that singing is my primary instrument. And playing guitar is kind of a secondary that just allows me to write songs so I can sing them.
Kyle, thank you for your music. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks again for having me, Kate. I really appreciate it.
That is Milwaukee singer-songwriter Kyle Furick with his new folk rock album. It's called Shine On. His band is fresh off playing Summerfest in Milwaukee, and their next performance is August 13th at Ope Brewing Company in West Allis. Here's more from the title track, Shine On.
Do you want to rock? Well, I mean, not the music, but like an actual rock.
This is a great time of year to look for cool rocks and stones on beaches and elsewhere. And we want to hear from the rock enthusiasts of Wisconsin. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or leave a message at 888-642-0232.
Do you like to look for cool rocks? Do you collect them? Do you have a rock tumbler and a collection of polished rocks? What are the coolest things you found in Wisconsin and maybe beyond?
And do you have questions about identifying rocks? We can get into them answered in a future conversation.
Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you could call and leave us a message. That number is 888-642-0232. 0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence and Lauren Cox.
Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Brad Kohlberg. Tim Peterson is our acting executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.